Welcome to the One Gang Worldwide Podcast, your ultimate ride into the world of motorcycles. Visit cyclesworldwide.com where we offer a completely free marketplace for everything motorcycles. Join our One Gang community where you can connect, share info, and swap stories with riders from all over the world. Join for free at cyclesworldwide.com and be a part of the One Gang community right now. On today's episode of the One Gang Worldwide Podcast, we're exploring the world of bespoke motorcycle manufacturing with two key figures from Janus Motorcycles, Richard Worsham and Grant Langenbach. In this episode, Richard and Grant will share the story behind Janus Motorcycles, their philosophy of combining classic design with modern craftsmanship, and their vision for the future of boutique motorcycle production. Whether you're a fan of retro aesthetics or interested in the nuances of small-scale manufacturing, you're going to dig it. So get ready for a chat with the masterminds behind Janus Motorcycles right here on the One Gang Podcast.
At the landscape of just like, man, this is a story that needs to be told. And it is exciting to tell and exciting to talk about, and the backstory behind the manufacturing and the craftsmanship and the design that goes into it. It's fun.
Hey guys, welcome to the One Gang Worldwide Podcast. We got an awesome one today, man. I've been extremely looking forward to getting both of these guys on. They're from Janus Motorcycles, Richard Worsham, who's the founder, and Grant Langenbach, who's the president. Great American company here in Indiana. So welcome to the show, guys. Extremely pleased to have you both on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having us on. Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. We're happy to have you guys here. Let's start, I guess, one at a time. We'll ask you how you grew up, where you grew up, and how your love and interest in motorcycles originally started.
You got it.
Go for it.
Yep. Well, I'm a Goshen guy. So I was I'm a Hoosier through and through. My dad was a small business owner. He was a veterinarian. My mom was a school teacher. I grew up 5 miles down the road, went to high school here. Our other partner that's not on the program today, Jordan, and I went to high school together. Our fender bender and I were in first grade together. I tried to move away several times. I've lived on the East Coast and on the West Coast and in Michigan, and I kept on coming back because Goshen's just a great place to live and raise a family. And it's great to tell people what our rent is here from either coast, and they drop. You can have a really wonderful life in little Goshen, Indiana. That's why I'm here. I got into motorcycling when I rekindled my friendship with Jordan, who is our video and YouTube, the man behind the curtain on our YouTube channel. We both bought vintage, like 80s. He bought a BMW, I bought a Yamaha, and we'd drink Miller High Lifes and eat donuts in the garage on Saturday mornings and work on our models. We were both working. Yeah, I know, right? we were both working in the agriculture industry in marketing.
What was the first bike that you bought? Which one was your first bike?
I had an 82 Yamaha 650.
Nice. Okay,
cool. The XJ650. It was not very cool, but I learned a lot on it.
First bike. You learned how to wrench on it. I mean, that's the great thing about the first bike.
That was cool. I was going through some personal stuff at the time, and like a lot of people, having something to work on was really therapeutic, and learning something new and making new friends. And Jordan and I did a lot of kind of marketing on the side, creative work, a lot of video work. And we joked, his sister-in-law's brother or, something like that, started a whiskey company. So we did a photo shoot for them. And then we had our liquor contract, and then lo and behold, we had an automotive manufacturer in downtown Goshen. So we basically cajoled Richard into letting us run marketing for Janus. That was a long time ago. And there was maybe one sixth of the amount of people involved in the company. Wow. But that's how we got really into motorcycling after that. Jordan and I ran the Kickstarter campaign for the 250 line back in 2015. And the rest is history and current history.
What about you, Richard? Yeah. Where did you grow up, and what was your first intro to the bikes?
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia, so a very different climate and kind of riding environment. Although when I was a child, I really wasn't as interested in motorcycles. I always say I was really more fascinated with cars. Now, I was interested in like vintage cars and was really lucky to have parents that kind of fostered that.
Nice.
So father was an architect and I got to kind of experience at that point. He still actually does a lot of hand drawing, hand drafting, but he was mostly doing hand drafting pre-CAD. And so seeing sections and elevations, it just, you know, you're kind of copying what you mm-hmm. see around you. And I would draw elevations and kind of sections of what I was interested in, which were cars. And so I actually had, cool. you know, kind of that, you know, this ideal motorcycle company that was named after mine, that I named after my middle name. And, but no motorcycles really, until my mother got an old two-stroke Vespa. And that was sort of the starting point for my brothers and I riding. We moved to Richmond, Virginia, riding all over the city, the trouble on the 50cc with like 30 miles an hour.
That's the sidewalk one, right?
Yeah. Or we were all over the place. Yeah. So, and then when I went to school out here, so I went to undergrad in New Hampshire and just really enjoyed that. And then went to grad school here in Notre Dame, which is about 40 minutes mm-hmm. west of here. And the only vehicle I brought with me was a 1978 Gorelli moped.
Nice.
That should tell you a little bit about how much I understood about Indiana. Northern Indiana.
This is going to be a lot of fun, man. I can already see it.
Sleds. Yeah.
No, I ended up getting, going out on, you know, wiping it ice on Angela, which is the main street right in front of Notre Dame, realizing the car behind me probably couldn't stop either, jumping off and my bike.
Wow.
And so yeah, it was really like, at that point I was like, snow, I'm going to not ride this
stick
anymore.
To the vintage cars, man, right? That's funny. So,
at that point I started riding my old moped, which needed repair work periodically or frequently, out to Elkhart, Indiana, where there was a vintage moped repair shop and moped club. There at that time, there still is something called the Moped Army, which is this large nationwide organization founded out of Kalamazoo, Michigan, of all places. Wow. Supported, kind of fostered this crazy community of people tuning, riding, and recovering these vintage. Typically, I mean, like, I want to say like 75% of mopeds are from like 1970.
Yeah.
So the world. Mm-hmm. So it's likely that you have, mine was 1978 too. But around that year, people to this day, there are still 20 different gangs around in the main cities. And it's kind of this kind of joking. They call themselves gangs. They, you know.
Scooter gang.
Right. Yeah.
One of them is the Hot and Ready's.
The Hot and Ready's from Chicago.
They bring Hot and Ready's, huh? No.
Well, pizza racks on their moped.
the one.
Anyway, when I say moped, I'm talking about the old, like,
the push to start, and then it goes. Yep, of course.
So, the guy who ran that shop, Devin, and I'm friends, and I started working there in the summer, basically just service work, repairing of bikes, and that gradually over about 2 or 3 years turned into custom work. We started actually getting people who wanted their mopeds customized from Chicago.
No kidding. Wow.
All over the, really, really extreme.
What would you do for customization of a moped, man? Well, A-pangers, 21 inch A-pangers or what?
Really, what we were trying to do was make them look like little motorcycles.
Got it.
Like little cafe racers. And this was kind of this is 2007, 8, 9, really the height of cafe racer craze. And so I wish I could pull up some pictures of these. They looked like little miniature cafe racers and a lot of work going into them. But through that work on especially like finding a powder coater was really a big step for us. We found a powder coater eventually about 20-30 minutes south of Elkhart, who is an Amish guy. Mm-hmm. And he powder coated mostly, primarily tractor parts. But that really was the beginning, was when we realized, oh, there's this RV industry, first of all. In Elkhart County, that's where 80% of RVs are made here. But then there's this Amish community, very large, that is kind of is part of that manufacturing. And they run their own machine shops and powder coating and laser cutting and everything else. And so we realized very quickly that through that first powder coater, that we had access to essentially everything we needed to manufacture things from scratch. And so the first thing we did was it was really a personal project. We went to a couple of our friends, and actually Responsible John was one of them, and us, and said, hey, let's all pool our money, and we're going to build a run of half a dozen from scratch mopeds that are built the way that, like, what we've been trying to do to these custom bikes, changing other designs, we're going to do the way we want. And at that point, I was really interested in the kind of ultimate expression of that is the 50cc grand prize bikes of the 60s and 70s, where they're these, like, they're about, you know, yay wide.
Right.
There's nothing extra on them.
Right.
And so that's what we sought to build.
That's cool.
And gradually found all the people that we would need to be able to do the aluminum tank, chassis, and all that kind of stuff.
That's so interesting, man.
That was the spark.
Well, the great thing is you guys both come from two different backgrounds. Richard, you're a designer, draftsman, architect. You had your own small business, a press, right? It was a press company you did something with press?
Yeah, we had a little letterpress printing company. Man, you've done your research.
And Grant, you come more from the graphic design photography world. You also had your own small business. Take us a little bit into that part of your life before Janus, like what you guys were up to and, you know, what made you kind of decide to try something different?
That's a good question. I think the roundabout way of answering that is what has been, has always, been amazing to me about Janus is what you can do when you get, the right people under the same roof. And no one here is spectacular. We have a lot of all-stars, but there's no like heroes here, I would say. And I don't mean that as a dig, but it's like you get this critical mass of people that just think they can and don't take no for an answer and just like keep on trying to work on something have really deep passion about photography or design or tuning. We have some of the best tuners in Elkhart County, I guarantee, and maybe Northern Indiana, and, you know, motorcycle people working for us and folks that are just crazy about welding and crazy about metal forming, and that just, you know, so you start to bolt these people together, and then you realize that you have a really awesome team that's capable of way more than what one human could do.
Right.
Which, to bring that around to me, is it's Jordan and I, what we brought to the table was just a lot of passion for the marketing and telling the story and the creative side of how we eliminate that to folks, both internally, remind people on the team how cool of a job they're doing is, and externally, and tell the story. That it's the storytelling aspect of it. I'm more so than my previous jobs, I would say that my, I would say that all of marketing is remembering how to write an English essay, and that's tell people what you're going to tell them, and then remind people what you told them. Right. And just keep on doing that. And, you know, being able to think clearly and write clearly, and the amount of time that Richard and I spend talking about how we talk about the bikes is maybe seems crazy, but it's really important for because we allow our customers to have a language to appreciate their bikes with too, because they are weird.
What was it that got you into the design, like the graphic design, photography world growing up? What was it that intrigued you to go down that road?
I grew up with a pencil and a paintbrush in my hand. I was very
so you were an artist right from the beginning. Nice.
And I got into photography because my dad had similar, you know, kind of story. My dad had the equipment, so I could either watch him using it or I could use it on my own. And B, it was easy to take to college and easy to take on a trip, and you could, you know, kind of flex your creative, scratch the creative itch without getting out your, you know, all of your paint set or having to set up a drafting table or something. And then I realized that I could make a little bit of money from it too. It's way harder to make money doing photography now than it was 15 years ago. That's how that all started. And even just the creative aspect of writing, I love the creative aspect of marketing, and honestly, the creative aspect of running a company, of setting up its little world building. You know, you're thinking about what the system needs next, and what the team needs next, and how we talk about it, and how we create something cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, and Richard, your dad was architect also, or?
Yeah. My father is an architect. My mother's an architectural historian. So we grew up very much in the historic building realm. My father, he was a Hokie, and then went on to get a graduate degree at UVA. So he kind of bridged But while he was there, he studied under a teacher who was very inspiring for him in terms of classical architecture. So kind of like basically like in the 1970s, the only kind of architecture, well, I still to this day, it's true, the only kind of architecture that most schools teach is a very different kind of architecture than most of the history of building has engaged.
Right. So
modernism, that's called modernism. It's kind of this very different approach. And so he had been kind of trying to do that on his own and found this teacher that was really changed him. And that was one of the reasons that Westfall, that professor, moved to Notre Dame and was teaching there. And he suggested, after I had a literature degree, which I was really excited about, and I'm still very passionate about literature and poetry. But he said, well, he's teaching out at Notre Dame. You should go and just for the theory, the architectural theory. And that was my undergraduate. I just was connecting the dots on this a couple of days ago. My undergraduate thesis was on recovering tradition. And then I go to this classical architecture school that's really very unique in the world that actually teaches this stuff. And it not only teaches that, it teaches how to do hand drafting, like Beaux-Arts style watercolor watercoloring, very artistic, very hands-on approach. And it was really, I went for the theory, but I picked up and really enjoyed the art kind of side of it.
That's awesome.
And so that interest in the past and being aware of it and letting it play more of a role in our present and maybe possibly, I hope, inform our future, it was a big part of kind of what I was doing. And so maybe that's kind of my in with it.
That doesn't have anything to do with Janus.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where I'm going.
But in a way it does, right? Because we'll get into obviously the bikes a little bit later in the show, but your history, right? So I'm the same way. I believe that the stuff created before is built much better than the stuff created now. And it's different, you know, it lasts longer through the test of time, but I can see the way, one, by your photography and what you do, Brant, and then in addition to the way you design, Richard, everything comes from the past. You guys still even do the pictures and the way you set everything up, where it's kind of like more in a classic. It's not like so modern like everything else that it's boring. I love that about that. So, and we'll get into that in the show later, man. So that's cool. Really, really cool. So,
yeah. So, you know, it's funny. You may feel like you don't have spectacular individuals, but you guys absolutely produce these spectacular works of art.
I mean that in the fact that we have amazing individuals here, and it's like the Justice League or something. You get these like
the team verticals. Is spectacular.
Yeah, they have these, you know, these vertical knowledge bases that are so deep, or these like unique skill sets that just like, as a one person, there's no way that I could run a motorcycle company, or there's no one way that our, you know, certification expert could even begin to sell motorcycles. Right. But you start putting these, you know,
pieces together
all in the same room.
Yeah.
Obviously there's, you know, challenges that come with that too, but like then you're able to start seeing like this multiplying factor of, this is an organization that is putting out some really high art, I would say. Mm-hmm. And that's
absolutely
more than one thing to do in their garage.
Hands down. I'm curious, with that said, the work that you guys are doing is absolutely amazing. And I'm curious if you could take the audience through Richard in 2011, starting the company. What transpired for really, what was the inspiration for you to start Janus outside of customizing mopeds? And what vision at the time did you have for Janus, and how have you seen that come to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that first bike we built, the we were supposed to be half a dozen of them, turned out to be one, took a lot longer than we thought going to, but we built it. And when we got it photographed, you know, a nice studio photo shoot with a friend of ours from the moped world. It got some attention and I want to say even really, really, it was locally that people were like, hey, you should like do something with this. And I think that kind of speaks a little bit to the manufacturing entrepreneurial, building blocks of this area of the country. And people would actually say that to you. Cause normally you'd expect people to be like, yeah, you are crazy. Mm-hmm. And don't believe me. We've gotten plenty of that too, but, yeah. And so we just kind of, I mean, it was 3 months after I graduated, I had my youngest daughter just born. We were like, let's do this. Let's start a company here. And we just got off the ground. And those first bikes were, it's been really a kind of stepping stones for us up mm-hmm. to what we're working on now. Cause we had that moped background, which really is important, is significant mm-hmm. to what we do. The small displacement, lightweight idea. Right. Cause that was, to kind of go back a little bit to like why I had never been interested in motorcycles is, you know, my experience with motorcycles for the most part was seeing big, loud, heavy bikes. Right. And I witnessed the aftermath of an accident and I thought, why would you do that? You know, but the design, the aesthetic stuff and the design, I really appreciated. So the approachability and the uniqueness and the sort of like, you didn't have to dress up in, you know, like a Harley outfit
right.
to enjoy a motorcycle. I mean, that was sort of the end for me. So the first bikes we built was a version of our Halcyon, which I would basically characterizes what mm-hmm. we do really well, that model.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 50cc two-stroke motor, essentially a moped without pedals. You know, it's a little six-speed motorcycle. And at that stage in the company, it was a incremental development. So one bike, we were selling 10 bikes a year at first. And one bike would fund the next one and we didn't pay ourselves anything. And it was just sort of gradually kind of trying to make something work. I mean, that went along okay for a number, but 3 years we built around 43 of those 50 CCs. And at which point I actually had moved back to Virginia to practice architecture because I wasn't making enough money with a family. But I was handling kind of the sales and marketing aspect while my business partner was handling, they're just building the bikes and dealing with the fabric.
Is that Devin?
That was Devin, dealing with suppliers and that aspect of it. So 2014, we had been working with Jordan, I think at
mm-hmm.
first,
mm-hmm.
and we got some really good photographs and I thought, oh, this is really neat. And then we started talking more with Grant
mm-hmm.
and we're like, if we're going to do this, we got to do it. And I just went all in, quit my job and, you know, built a plywood box to put all our stuff in and trailered it out here. We kind of really dug in. That's when we launched a Kickstarter campaign mm-hmm. for the 250.
Yep.
So
that you're saying the orange poster behind me, that's the Kickstarter poster.
And that was the look. It was that lightweight.
What was your vision from the design? Going back to your, you like the classic stuff. Were you kind of looking at the bikes from the early teens? Was that kind of like something that inspired the look that you have now?
Yeah. So it kind of transformed, because that first bike we built, the Paragon, was styled after a 1960s kind of GP bike, 50cc. And that was, again, remember we were in this Cafe Racer, so we thought, first model is going to be a cafe racer. That's what people like. That's what we like. That was really my experience of what a cool looking motorcycle was. However, around that same time, I started following the Vintagent. I don't know if you're familiar with his Paul d'Orléans. And he had, he just was really cool. He was just write blog posts about history. And I thought, oh, this is really, this is up my alley. And he started writing about 1920s bikes. And then he featured a builder named Ian Berry of Falcon Motorcycles out of LA. Ian was building what I thought of this. When I thought custom motorcycles at the time, I either thought, you know, kind of a 59 Club 59 Cafe Racer or like a Chopper. Mm-hmm. And the Chopper is just, I think they're cool. I've gotten into it more over the years, but it wasn't really ticking the boxes for me. But Ian Berry was building, like, he did a Triumph, I think, at first. And then he did a Vincent. And they were just, like, really different. And they were fully customized, but they looked like something maybe you might have found. They're kind of steampunk, really. Mm-hmm. And it caught my attention. And I got massively derailed by it. And it was like, oh, we're going to make this cafe racer. Actually, what if we made it? I said to my business partner, what if we made it a hardtail?
Wow.
And what if the leather bags on the back?
Right.
And so we two-stroke 50cc water-cooled engine and put it in a kind of what some people have described as a baby broth Superior. And that was kind of the beginning. And since then, I've just fallen really deeply into that rabbit hole of the kind of machines that were being built in that era, especially motor vehicles. For a variety of reasons, they were much more successful, I think, at being motorcycles than a lot of what's currently available. If you really dig into why people charmed by motors. Yep.
So Grant, coming in 2014 as the sales marketing director, what motivated you and what inspired you to hop on board officially with Janus?
Yeah, the clarity of the vision, I think, in some way. I mean, it was a unique point of view, and it was fun to think about doing, having a, I call it our own little corner of the playground. There still is a huge custom scene out there, and it's flourishing and awesome. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this was a really unique offering. Not that I had job offers from other, you know, manufacturers at all. I'm just like, but if just looking at the landscape of just like, man, this is a story that needs to be told. And it is exciting to tell and exciting to talk about, and the backstory behind the manufacturing and the craftsmanship and the design that goes into it. It's just really, it's fun.
That's cool. Yeah.
No, it's, there's probably a better word for that, but that's kind of what I tell our sales team. I tell our, you know, marketing team that people get into motorcycling for human flourishing, not because it's that they're buying toilet paper.
Absolutely. Good advice on that.
Well, they get into motorcycling because it's something human and wonderful that they can do.
Yeah.
And it's, that's what I felt like a Janus was more, I buy into the idea that a Janus does that in a more distilled sense than a lot of bikes that kind of hide behind a lot of features and a lot of, you know, this is a distilled, it's like the, you know, highest approved version of motorcycling.
Yeah.
It might not be for everybody. And some people it's a,
That's a great way of putting it.
Wow. That
distilled is
strong,
a great word. Yeah.
It's a strong flavor, but it's, if you want to hit at what the actual spirit of motorcycling is, it's about knowing what's going on between your legs. It's about feeling the independence that you can, and the confidence that comes with that independence without feeling like you're the one being ridden. you're the pilot, you're in control. Also, you know what you feel confident and empowered to work on your own machine and to customize it and to tell people about it and to have something beautiful. That's something really human. And it's cool.
That's awesome.
Purity of it.
Hey, Richard, I wanted to ask you a question, kind of going back to the 2011 part where you guys started building them and you had that period where you didn't know if you were going to continue, but then kind of going forward, you decided to go forward and move back. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in the early days, and kind of like, how did you overcome them? Because see, like most people, they see the finished product, so they don't understand, unless they've owned their own business, how hard it is to be able to not only put a team together and consistently produce and always put the money back into the business instead of putting it, you know, and you take care of your bills, pay your team, and then the rest goes into everything else. Can you take us into the early days, just some of the things that you, obstacles that you went through, what were some of the challenges and how you overcame them?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that wasn't a challenge was finding people to do the stuff. And that was because we are where we are. So on some level, like if we had been in a different location, we would have had to assemble a team earlier in the process, and we would have had to have a much larger facility. And instead, I still kind of, when we have a discovery day or give a tour, I say, you have to imagine this little building or this dry cold, vintage dry cleaner we're in is only a part of the Janus factory. It extends over the entire county. And if it was all in one place, it would probably be like a city block.
Right, right.
Of all the people that are doing different various tasks. So that wasn't a challenge. Really, the challenge was being able to make a living at it. I mean, that was just so challenging. Luckily, my family was very supportive. My wife was able to basically make the income we needed to allow this to happen.
That's awesome.
I was doing some side projects, but balancing that stuff was really challenging. Mm-hmm. The other challenge we had were we were limited in the number of motorcycles we were able to, so even if we could sell a lot of bikes, because we didn't have an EPA certificate or testing done, it's been with a two-stroke,
right?
We weren't able to really sell more than a very limited number of bikes. And so we knew there were a lot of big hurdles, people think, the barriers to entry to starting a brewery are significant, but areas to, DOT safety testing, these major agencies that are involved, EPA, California, ARB. And so that was like, okay, how are we going to navigate this? And then hiring, probably the most difficult thing was hiring our first employee and then paying yourself the first time.
Right.
That was like a major milestone.
I know.
And kind of like, well, we're just going to do this.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Big step.
Hey, did you guys, when you guys started building, were you using already titled frames like from old bikes and just using the frame? Or did you guys start putting, using new frames right out of the gate? Like, because before you created your own physical brand.
Yeah, the story of Janus is that we do everything the hardest possible way you can imagine.
Got it.
Yeah, we invented our own VIN system.
Killer.
We went from scratch on everything. And we still do for some things that like people are like, wait, you make that?
Yeah. Yep. And Grant, what about you, man? When you came on board, and obviously the company's only 3 years in the making. You see the big picture with it. You get to meet everybody there and everything's cool. What were some of the challenges that you went through on the marketing side, like from that aspect?
And finding customers, you got to do a lot of fast learning to figure out what you have your own hypothesis or your own assumptions about who is interested in what you're doing and about what they're interested in and about what's valuable. And then you start putting it in front of people and you quickly are disabused of most of those ideas. One of the coolest things we did early on, which was really it was a true discovery. We call it a discovery day, and we still do those in some form and fashion. It was a true discovery because our only entrance to the building was a garage door. So the only sign was this big, and there was a little button that you had to push, and people could tour on a Saturday morning. And that's marketing advice I have is marketing is, sales writ large, and you just have to get in there and talk to people and hear what they have to say and listen to them and shut up.
Yeah.
The language they use to talk about things.
Who did you pitch?
You learn a lot.
Who did you pitch in the beginning? What was your target? Were you going into dealerships, or were you going into, like, how were you, like, where were you going to target Janus?
Yeah, we did a lot of social media marketing, and we still do. That's our main driver of people involved and interested in what we do. Video is the background of what we do. Very early on, we kind of lived on the afterglow of some of our Kickstarter campaign, some great press that Richard and Devin got early on. We were featured in the Wall Street Journal in like 2016 as a part of this Cafe Racer kind of, you know, alongside folks that were, you know, customizing Ducatis and, you know,
big players in the custom scene.
Right. Awesome.
So kind of classical marketing, you want to have a mix of earned media and face-to-face marketing, you know, kind of, the way we talk about it. And, you know, one of our mentors says there's the information wars, there's the air wars and the ground wars, and you set the, you know, the creative stuff is how you talk about what you do, and the air is how you tell people about it, and the ground wars is how you actually get the money in hand. And that's sales and getting people in the door. And, you know, we would go to shows, and we would go to some of the vintage shows. We'd go to AMA Vintage Days. We'd go to Barber. We'd go to Handbuilt Show in Austin. We did that a couple times. We did, We did the one show back in 2016. And that was, we got our EPA certificate in
17?
Late 17, November, you know, 5th or something like that, 2017. So that's when we really started marketing in earnest.
Awesome.
And we do church advertising and social media advertising and some of the same mix of what we do before. And really the backbone of all that is video. We tell people that YouTube is our dealership. That's how they'd learn about us. That's how they'd learn to trust and know and like the team here and Richard and the story and all that stuff. And that's how they eventually, usually their spouse says, quit watching the damn videos and buy the bike already. That's, you know, that's kind of the buyer journey. Yep. So
that's cool.
Test right. I hear on the other side of my thick door, there's test riders here right now that have set up an appointment. I don't know, 3 weeks ago, and they're driving in from, we have people fly in and drive in from all over the country and all over the world. And, but we do it one sale at a time right now. So
that's it.
Yeah. So you guys touched on it a little bit, but I'm curious if you could go further into the design philosophy behind Janus and how Janus motorcycles are set apart from other bikes in the industry.
It's a lot of it is not by really isn't by design so much as by what we've fallen into because of the way that we can make things.
Uh-huh.
We have a certain number of limitations. What we can and can't do. Those limitations are becoming less strict as we grow and we get larger. But when we first started off, it really was like hand making every single piece with, I don't want to say rudimentary, but very basic tooling.
Right.
So we there was no way, and there still isn't really, that we're going to stamp a tank out of sheet metal with a, you know, $100,000, $300,000 press. It's, something that we were able to do with sheet metal aluminum and a brake press.
Wow.
And the same thing is true of the frame and the way that we, and perhaps the fact that my background is not in automotive design. I don't really have the baggage of why you have to make it, you know, look a certain way. We basically just kind of, it's almost early on. I remember joking about how we were reinventing everything except for the wheel, kind of starting from scratch. And that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is a very conscious attempt to build something that eschews the sort of plastic coated aesthetic that kind of, well, I guess it kind of goes back to the manufacturing process though, because for a lot of manufacturers, having things made that way is cheaper. But if you're trying to make it in a small shop, paying for the molds to make plastic parts is way out of our budget.
Absolutely.
So it was never even a question.
Absolutely.
We still, to this day, like having a plastic part made, like I wouldn't know how to tell you the first step.
Right.
Instead of an example of that, we got a quote for state. We were tired of our roll form fenders and we had a great, you know, that's how we did everything up till then, but we wanted to for different pricing and different designs and different, you know, we were having different models and there were just multiple complications that came from that. So we got a quote for, you know, stamping fenders, just fenders, right. You know, $350,000.
Wow.
So instead we buy a Swedish
Pullmax
from Sweden, put over to the United States, and we employ somebody with my friend from first grade, who's a dad is a famous ceramic artist, to make by hand our fenders one by one.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Cheaper, faster, and way cooler than process. And
it's actually cheaper than the roll forming we had done previous to that up the road. So when you include all the different extra operations that go into it, these are basically when they come off the machine, they're ready for paint.
Really?
It's crazy.
Really? They're ready for paint right off the machine. That's amazing.
Yep.
That's awesome.
So, and it's very fun and it gets everyone and our customers kind of creative mentality going to see that. So builds value for what we're doing at our scale.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And could you take us through the process of handcrafting each bike and maybe in comparison to what it was like when you guys first started to what it is now?
Yeah, it hasn't really changed a whole lot. And basically, we partner with a lot of local suppliers. It's developed, I guess. So let's say it starts with a drive out to the Amish. Most of the Amish that we work with are about 20 minutes southwest of us, and they call us the outer world. So we call them the inner world.
The outer world.
Nice. So about a 20-minute drive to the inner world, where originally what would have happened is my business partner and I, would the founder and I, would have developed handmade in the other shop, because we didn't have a shop. We had a little place where we assembled the bikes,
which is plywood still box. Kind of
Hey,
how big was the first space, that not to cut you off, that you guys were working
in?
How big was that?
First space is probably 600 square feet, something like that. The back that room, one bay, maybe a little bigger.
And now,
now we have a full building. I think we're at like 2,000.
Awesome.
1,600.
Yeah, more than that.
Oh, so sorry. It's like 6,000 square
feet. 6,000 square feet. And then we have our teaching. From 600 to 6,000, man. Awesome, guys. Great job.
Awesome.
So anyway, we would build the first version. And then they would build, and we would help. We actually helped initially build the tooling with them. So like a frame jig, all that stuff. And I had to kind of like look up on Google, you know, how I would do that. Cause I don't have a extensive like custom, car or you know, we weren't building off the back of a lot of the recent advances in jigging and all that kind of stuff, so we kind of just looked it up and did it our way. We're still using that same tooling on our 250 chassis, but then we would hand that off.
It's true with a plumb line.
No way.
We would hand those off once we had them in a place where we wanted to. We'd hand it off to the Amish shop and they would start producing it. And that's the same with most of the parts that we make locally.
That's awesome.
Now, in recent years, when we launched the 450, a big move we made, which has to do with prototyping speed as well as manufacturing, but we added another 6,000 square feet, a lovely location about 5 minutes south of here, where we make in-house the 450 chassis parts. And that's where we have our fenders being made. Mm-hmm. And we store a lot of parts, and our engineering department is down there. So we've started, like, our kind of goal, we'll see how it plays out fully, is to gradually bring different aspects of whether it's fabrication or development in-house. Because it helps us speed
things
up.
Of course,
and as we sort of grow, we recognize the value, one of the greatest values we offer. And we can talk about this more with product, is a very extreme level of customization. And so being able to offer variations in new things is very valuable. It's kind of leaning into what we do well. So having that ability to rapidly prototype and develop in-house has been really, really awesome.
That's awesome.
The other half of that story is that some parts
are just not made in the United States anymore. So you cannot find a small displacement engine. You cannot find a motorcycle wheel builder, like an actual, like rims. I don't care if you go to Buchanan, like they are making one line of rims that are very expensive. But most everything else is coming from overseas. Absolutely. Shock absorbers are in different, you know, all over the place. But we found that the most traditional ones are made literally on the other side of the world.
In Australia,
mm-hmm. you have this very, very, what we say, hyper local supply chain of a majority of the chassis, kind of the motorcycle, and then a lot of the specialty components like DOT lighting. Nobody's making that here.
Right.
Are coming from all over the place. And so it's a weird kind of conglomeration, and those parts you have to buy in larger quantities.
Of course.
And so it's kind of a balancing.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's kind of the story of how a motorcycle would start as a chassis, and then we have this, what we call the milk van, and with the milkman, and he's Ray. He drives every day one or more trips around the county, going to all these different shops, picking up powder coat, dropping off sandblast, picking up laser cut material, picking up different things, dropping it off, and it's making this constant loop where different parts that may not be used for another 3 weeks are in this, they're kind of going from one place to the next, gradually moving toward here, the downtown shop where we do pre-assembly of components, and then finally the final assembly, detailing, prepping for
pinstripe and paint.
Pinstripe and paint, but like it's all assembly and final fit and finish.
Yeah. Ray is like your Napa guy.
Yeah.
And that's what's beautiful. What you guys do is that not only is, you know, majority of the motorcycle made here in the States, but you also have other small businesses all around your area that are a part of this, which is so cool. You know, you're not outsourcing it from everywhere else. You stay within your community, and you get that. That's, I love that about Janus, that you guys really take a lot of pride.
Pragmatic approach. Yeah, it's. You know, like my short answer to, you know, it's easy to kind of caricature social media keyboard warriors, but they say, well, I'm buying none of that China crap.
Right.
And I say, you know what? You're right. We're going to down our operation. I'm going to fire 20 people tomorrow, and I'm going to cancel my contracts with 50 local individuals because I can't build something 100% domestic.
Yeah.
You can't tell me we love to keep on working towards that goal of, I would love for everything to be built in Elkhart County, but you don't do that by being a binary about it. You do it by incremental and by doing what you can and by building what you can, how you can, and being scrappy and also surviving. And
well, that's the history of motorcycles,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, totally. Like, yeah.
Motorcycles have always, some of the greatest brands have brought in different components, and it's what you do. I mean, I always joke with people like, do you really want me to start designing the motor and building the motor?
Hey, you're pretty creative. Both of you guys are pretty creative. I think you probably do something great.
Yeah, it'll look really good.
That's funny too. So it's like a parallel for the Amish and Janus is similar to what you can call hyperlocal to what you have to rely. You don't have a choice. You have to rely on the outer world. So that's your chance to be the inner world.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting point. So I'm curious, just for my geeky brain, going back to prototyping quickly, when you guys are going from digital to physical, what medium are you using for early prototyping, or are you just going full out legitimate part? Are you utilizing any kind of 3D printing, or what does that process look like?
So when we got started initially, I was coming straight out of architecture school. So I was doing hand drafting. Mm-hmm. And with the addition of CAD, but 2D CAD. So Autodesk product, like really like architectural.
It could have been Google Desk, right? Really?
Yeah. It was architecturally oriented stuff.
Sure.
A lot of the stuff, like let's say the Halcyon tank, which may be one of the most iconic designs we have, was almost 100% developed in metal on the shop floor. Because we just didn't have the ability to I mean, we would do cardboard mock-ups, a lot of cardboard mock-ups. But then as we've grown and as we, our need for able to document stuff more fully efficiency. And hold people, hold people accountable to what we ask.
Harder
we
needed to have much more development.
So we moved from CAD, literally, from CAD to a product called Onshape. About, it's been 6 years now or more. So Onshape is a 3D design software. It's basically like SolidWorks. It's actually founded by ex-SolidWorks executives. The difference is that it's much less expensive and it runs in your browser. And it has almost all the capabilities of SolidWorks. And every month we get more. So Charlie, our engineer, was just texting me yesterday, like, look, check this out. This is some, you know, a new feature we have. So yeah, we can do, we basically have, for all new things, we do full prints. We design it in 3D first, like you'd expect. And then with our engineer, young engineer we have, he's able to not only work in design, but he has the ability to fabricate and build prototypes. And then we can, and then also make the tooling that we can then make the part out of.
One of the, one of the superpowers that we have is our design engineer, Charlie, and the other fabrication skills that some of these, I mean, like the Chase and Ryan, these guys know intrinsically they're engineers, even if they're not trained engineers.
Degreed engineers.
They're degreed engineers. Intrinsically, they know how to build something. And it's in so many ways, that's way more valuable.
Oh, an applied understanding of engineering is, I mean, I'm just lucky. We're just lucky that our engineer actually knows how to build things. I don't think it would be very valuable if it was just a rule book engineer.
That's extremely rare too. Just visiting different shops around the country, you typically have this rift between the shop floor and the engineers. And you guys have seen that, I'm sure. That's incredibly unique. That's definitely an asset. That's really cool.
Hey, one of the cool things that we love, that your social media, I know you guys are very active, as you were saying, Grant, before. What I love about the things that you do is you guys actually, each one of you will do some form of a trip or a ride on the bike where it's kind of pushing it to the limits, right? So instead of having some, you know, stunt person test driving your bike, you guys do all the test drives, you document it. Obviously, the trips are fun. So if anybody hasn't seen it, we'll link the YouTube channel to the notes of this section. But take us a little bit through that. And then what happens? Like, take us through some of the rides on the bike, what kind of terrain and what kind of limits you've pushed it to. And when you've come back, have you guys made some changes, things that maybe that you saw by putting actual long miles on the bike that needed to be changed? Like, take us a little bit through that. Test driving part of it.
You should talk about your iron butt stuff too.
That's insane stuff.
A lot of it, I have to say, we've been very lucky that they've held up really well. I think a lot of that credit goes to the fact that we look a lot to the past, and so we're not redesigning really the wheel in any way, real way. We're using, like, the chassis we use is essentially a Norton featherbed frame.
The hardtail one.
The hardtail version, on the 250. We try and be as kind of conservative, and I don't know if conservative is the right word, really, but classical with the design. And so we're playing within a rule book that's very well established.
And the music analogy would be we play the standards and we might riff on them. We play out of, you know, classic American songbook of motorcycle design.
In terms of testing, it's something that we did most of our actual, like, the testing stuff that we didn't know what the outcome would be with the EPA. So in order to get your bike passed, it has to have completed a 250. So a class 2 motorcycle is anything under 280 cc's. Has to complete 15,000 kilometers of durability mileage. So the fact that we completed that for me was pretty telling of the, because that's a motorcycle that's being, at the time, SNS actually had a retired truck driver who actually sat on the motorcycle and rode it for 15,000 kilometers.
Really?
Jeez. Wow.
They've since replaced the driver. I hope he's living a good life somewhere in Wisconsin, but he's a robot now.
The fields are
okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was for us. We didn't have the budget or the time,
of course,
to be able to do. I mean, we did a lot of mileage, but it was not like, you know, just like, you know, we don't have a test track or something like that. Now, after the fact, we started doing a lot of kind of like feats of strength.
Yeah.
And so I've done, I got kind of, I didn't know much. I'd never heard of the Iron Butt Association until meeting a enthusiast. And he stopped in the shop initially to put up a sign for George Wyman, who was a famous motorcyclist, or the first person to ride a motor vehicle across country. He actually rode through Goshen, so a half block from our shop in 1903, riding cross country.
That's cool.
He rode most of the time. Other times he walked, but
pushing it, right?
with Tim, that Iron Butt rider, I recreated the Wyman route, and was able to. That was my first Iron Butt award. Met president of the Iron Butt Association. They were all really impressed with the fact that this little 250 was keeping up with BMWs and Goldwings.
Maybe an hour and a half late to dinner most nights, right?
More than that.
But I can't imagine like the conversation they have. Is this the night that Richard doesn't show up? Yeah. You know, it's like, when is he going to drop out? And you always pull in and you're like, they're like, oh my God.
Yeah, but it's there again. But here's the key. You were always the topic of conversation, and that's the good part, man.
Right.
So then after that, I've been like around the Lake Michigan 1000. We did one with a buddy and I rode two Halcyon 250s from Goshen to New Orleans in 24 hours. And those really, I mean, they were great marketing, but they also helped cement in my mind just how much I believe in the bikes.
Absolutely.
And I was able to trust them.
Absolutely.
Talk about them confidently with customers.
We've had customers get a burr under their saddle. One of our customers, Tim, just decided on a whim to take his bike to Dead Horse. Mm-hmm. And he called us, you know, 2 hours out of Dead Horse and said, I hit a pothole and I ate a, you know, I broke a, you know, something, a foot peg or something.
Bent an axle. Yeah.
Right. Needs a new wheel. Can you overnight the Dead Horse, Alaska? We're like, why the hell are you in Dead Horse? And I did it on my DR or something.
He did it on his KLR and it was like super easy and there was no rain. And then he did it again on the tube and it rained the entire time.
Oh, gosh.
So he did the first trip and he sent us those pictures. So we've got a, you know, plaque sitting in the showroom on Tim and his journey. And so it's really cool to see. We will not win any racetrack events, at least speed events currently. But fun to have these moments where we say, look, it's not a plaything. It's something that's going to transport you wherever you want to go.
You guys have never advertised as speed demons anyway. Your whole thing was functionality.
You have a flat track
functionality up this year. And beauty and reliability and affordability. Right. So everything into one. So that's what makes your guys bike so special. For sure.
What was the second part of all?
The second part was actually like, did you guys, when you did these long rides, were there changes? Like, what were some of the things that you decided that, hey, maybe we should do this instead of this?
Yeah. So a great example is like what Grant just said. Our engineer, Charlie, in the last 2 years has taken, first he took the prototype, it's the same bike actually, out to Colorado. So he's riding a Halcyon 450, which is not an off-road machine designed, at least, to some very remote locations in Colorado, gold panning and video vlogging the whole thing. And that was really the reason we launched the Griffin 450, was Charlie got really excited about that, what he was learning about the bike out there, and really wanted to create the Griffin or a 450 version of the 250. And that's, he took a lot of what he learned, really abusing 450 Halcyon up there. I mean, just go watch some of the videos. He's crashing it and he's dropping it and hitting rocks.
The intro to one of the videos
You want to see a grown man lose all his teeth?
He doesn't lose any teeth. I'm fine, but it's got a great sense of humor about it. So
that was actually my next question: is the inspiration for the 450? So you've got the Halcyon and the Phoenix, or the Griffin rather. The Phoenix is still just 250. Was there any other kind of inspiration for branching out and going up to the 450 outside of Charlie and losing his teeth?
Yeah. I think that Richard describes it really well, is that the 250 and 450 are both like our attempts at making the perfect motorcycle, and they kind of hit at it in different directions. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the 450 is just the bike for people if they live in Los Angeles or else. But as a to put a, you know, like a little point on it, is that it's highway capable, but it still tries to keep the spirit of what, how fun it is to ride a small displacement, lightweight machine. It's 100 pounds heavier. It's got more than twice the horsepower. It'll do the ton if you want. It'll get on and off the freeway, but it still tries to like get that nugget of what it means to ride a Janus.
Right.
In some ways, the 250 in different ways is a little better at that because it's carbureted and it's 100 pounds light and it's, you know, it's just the stupidest, simple, beautiful little motor that you can imagine, a pushrod two valve motor. Like it is, it's the highest proof, you know, motorcycle you can imagine. It's like real motorcycle. But they kind of serve to aim at the same goal of creating something that's really a unique riding experience for people. That's not exclusive to, you know, again, this is the second or third or 300th motorcycle that a lot of our owners ride, but it's such a distilled and different flavor that it, that's what is valuable to them. And that's what, it, you know, makes it fun to sell.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good answer to
that.
No,
it is.
There's any other...
It is for sure. Well, what made you guys decide to go with 250? I know the 450 just came in a couple of years ago, but what was it about the engine that you guys are currently using? The manufacturer, did you kind of weigh options of which way you were going to go, which motors you were going to use? Like, take us a little bit into that, because I think it's an important part of the reliability of what you guys have now. So can you take us a little bit into the decision making on why you chose to go with this manufacturer outside of others?
Yeah. We have a two-part post on our blog about the deep kind of history and selection of the 250 motor. In that blog, we titled it the Bulletproof 250. And that, I think, really well summed up what we're talking about with that engine. And it's helped, I think, to talk for owners to understand it and for us to talk about it. But when we had this two-stroke, this 50cc two-stroke, and our background was entirely two-strokes. The only thing I knew about four strokes was a car and a lawnmower.
Right.
So it was a kind of a learning curve because our background was in, like, we made expansion chambers for two strokes, like kind of pretty out there on the two stroke right. edge, taking 2.5 horsepower motors and making you put out 14. So we learned a lot about it. We looked at a variety of engines. We looked at a Franco Marini. We looked at some Italian engines. The monkey motor briefly, it just didn't seem to be the right call. And we knew that we wanted something that had a long production history, right. high reliability and extreme ease of maintenance. So the monkey motor would be a good option there. Doesn't really necessarily have the power. We felt like our 250 went about 55 and we knew that
50, sorry,
what
50 went,
sorry, the 50 C, yep. 50 CC went 55. And we knew that just wasn't fast enough
right.
for the modern, even the modern two lane. You need to be able to go a little bit faster than that to have a motorcycle that fits that sweet yeah. spot. So we started looking at motors that were available. And there's the most famous like little small motor would be like the CB125 was kind of like the epitome, but we couldn't find those. But the CG is the younger sibling of the ugly, slow sibling of the CB. And it's an overhead valve, push rod, very simple. And it was completely, it was the its raison d'etre was to have a motor that was low maintenance, developed by Honda. So, it just so happened that there was another manufacturer in the States that was selling those motors. And at this point it was a major gamble for us to get an engine in. And we knew that it had EPA, so it was capable of passing EPA, this power plant. So we tried that one. We tried another engine, from a different manufacturer. And then we found another small brand that had a US importer, that we also tried, and we were really impressed with the little motor with this importer in LA. And so we thought, well, at a certain point, we're just going to have to make a call, make a gamble on this. And EPA will tell if it passes through this. So we took it to EPA or to SNS, who's the consultant.
Right.
There are no EPA motorcycle test labs. And they were incredibly helpful in kind of guiding us through, for one, learning about four strokes, but also evaluating the reliability of the engine based on their experience, extensive experience, obviously, with motors. Yep. But what they kind of taught me about was that the emissions of an engine are a really good sign of its quality. So if it's low emissions and it runs smoothly and over time, then that's a sign that this is a high tolerance, well-made engine.
Reliably.
And also from our limited understanding of working with some vintage Hondas and two strokes, we were able to recognize piston quality, rings, in gap, all this stuff, like just kind of like looking at it, we're like, hey, this is looking like better quality than a vintage Honda motor. So anyway, the first test we did with SNS, we passed the emissions test without a catalyst, which was a pretty significant to us. And then meanwhile, I'm like doing the history research on this motor and thinking, okay, this is it. If this motor is high quality enough, the history of this engine is been made for 40 years. There are more of these engines than anything else, terms of motorcycles, especially in developing markets
where they're beat up the most,
where they're abused. Maintenance is not preventative. It is when you rebuild it because it stopped. So yeah, that was really the history of that. And the move to 250 was wanting something that was low power and wouldn't be taxed. We don't have a tax on the 250 because it doesn't need one, because you'll never over rev it.
Right.
Understand. Hey, let me ask you this, guys. As far as if a customer that's not close to you, like say a customer orders the motorcycle, and we'll get into that part of it in the next couple of questions, but I just wanted to find out, like, these bikes are pretty easy, or I don't want to say easy because nothing is easy, but relatively simple to work on. So most mechanics can change the oil, can fix this, can fix that, correct? Just for people not to have to worry about, if they're not located in Indiana, but the bike's going to go to Massachusetts or to Florida, that a local mechanic can take care of what needs to be taken care of.
Yeah, for a lot of our customers, the maintenance, either preventative or responsive maintenance, is part of what they like about it. It feels like they're working on an old Honda, because they are in some ways. So a lot of, like, our warranty, we have a 4-year warranty on the 250 because it's for us to say, oh, Bob, you need a new, you dropped it and you, well, that's a bad example. They'd pay for a clutch lever, but you need a, something wore out.
Right.
You know how to install it. That's okay. For more extensive stuff, or if somebody has an accident or, something needs some more diagnostics, we have a really good track record of calling ahead to vintage Honda shops. It's not the power sports dealer that doesn't service anything older than 2010. It's some mom and pop Honda shop that works on vintage everything. We've got one down the street here, and we say, hey, in the early days, they're like, wow, who the hell are you? Now we're having a little bit more name recognition, but still sometimes but we pave the way and we say, this is, we got your back. We ship parts same day. We're going to pay the bill for this customer. He's going to bring it to you. Let us know what you need. And it's a great experience.
That's awesome. Awesome. Great job, guys.
So it's kind of become a little barnacle on the service network that already exists in the US. So YouTube might be our sales wing of the dealership, but we just rely on our customers, and awesome.
It's really a big part of it.
Absolutely.
I think the appeal to me, the reason that I liked mopeds was that I, without being a mechanic, could basically rebuild it down to the bearings.
Right.
Without basic tools. And I think that that's really an empowering sort of sense of agency when you're able to do your valves, even if it's something simple like changing your oil. It's just so easy. Mm-hmm. It's so easy. You have no specialty tools. Anyone can do it. And we can, and we have a video on YouTube that walks how to do it on this machine. And we celebrate that, and we don't penalize you. Like, if you do work on your bike, it's actually going to that's what we encourage you to do, not discourage.
Right. Cause it's expensive to bring it, to get it fixed. And that's what I love about what you guys are doing, man. I love that factor that most of these big dealers, man, they just sell the bike and then they run from problems, right? So if there's a problem, they're like, they always look for reasons not to help the customer. What I love about what you guys are doing is you take it into, you bring that small business family approach, like, hey man, now you're part of the family. If there's something, you let us know what's taking place. We'll help you out in any way we can. And that's phenomenal, man.
I wouldn't know the first part of that. I've never bought a new motorcycle before.
Yeah, me neither. Me neither.
I old Prince's and old Yamaha's.
And you guys have a massive presence on YouTube. You have so many videos, but there are also so many third party guys in their garage that post videos of just their experiences. And I don't know if there's anything that you'd run into on your bikes that you could find how to solve on YouTube. It's massive asset.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some really passionate owners too that just like do. Pete, one of our 450 owners, has done 25,000 miles on his 450 in 11 months.
Nice.
We have guys who do extensive video reviews and like write handwritten letters to. I mean, we have a really great community, and we just want to find.
Hey,
I sent out a survey
if you guys need a rider to put another 25,000 miles on one of your 450s, call me anytime, man. I'd love to, man.
We've got to get you up here to Relton.
Yeah, we will. We will. Yep. We'll be there for sure.
Taking a step back and just acknowledging this, building your own brand of motorcycles since 2011 is again, just getting that in perspective is so cool. It's so amazing. You know, yourself picked up by the bootstraps and just after it. And the success that you guys have seen is absolutely awesome. And I'm curious, you know, at this point, how many bikes do you guys think you've built since 2011? And then what does the future look like for you guys? What are your goals?
Mm-hmm. We have about 1,600 motorcycles on the road right now.
Wow.
Last year we built about 250, I think. We've been doing 250 to 300 for the last couple of years, but we, part of that, COVID was challenging. We sold a lot of motorcycles. It introduced some interesting challenges for just employment and the economy and the supply chain and, you know, just weaving our way through that. But the next 7 years, we have some, we've got our mountain legs under us. We're good at making the big climbs. We've 12x'd since 2015, and our goal is to get to almost do that again. We'd love to be doing about 1,200 motorcycles a year, which is still, you know, baby numbers.
Right.
But
yeah,
based on, you know, our history and what we've learned about what kind of experience we can provide people and what is valuable about our motorcycles, it feels like that's still within the current iteration of what we do, that we're not stamping everything out, and we're not slapping vinyl on it, and we're not, you know, injection molding bodywork. Can it provide create a really beautiful piece of art that's individual for customers and still has a bespoke feel to it, and that we're still able to have some level of connection with our customers. So
awesome.
Yeah. And so to crystallize that goal and creating that exponential momentum, what is that first step? What's that next priority, main priority for you guys to get to?
The Griffin 450 is part of that. Over the last year, we've really taken a really aggressive product and upgrade launch calendar just to
keep new things going through. One of the things that, you know, COVID really caused us kind of to hunker down in some ways. And we launched the 450, and it was, that was a huge undertaking in a very tumultuous year and getting that on the market. And now it's time to kind of fly a little faster, and we'll be seeing some really awesome, you're already starting to see some awesome fender upgrades. We're really trying to set our artists at off and running and say, let's create more, let's be more unique and create more variation and more interesting things that make these bikes more different.
More and more potential for every customer to make their bike completely different than everybody else.
Yeah, that's cool. We're definitely going to, how big is your team overall now? Like how many employees does Janice have?
There's probably 24 people that would, man. You know, it's
awesome.
You know, get a 18 to 19 full-time, I would say right now. I can't remember, but that's about right. And we have a stable of folks that do some part-time work for us, or part-time servants or part-time deliveries. And there's about hands that touch a bike.
If you guys are going to try to hit the goal that you're trying to shoot for 1200 bikes a year, and obviously it's as you're progressing, but are you looking to bring on additional staff at this point, or do you feel like your crew can handle most of this?
We would need to bring people on. One of the things that's so interesting about doing it this way, and kind of like I was joking about earlier about doing it the hard way, is that we do everything. And so under this roof, you have not only the design, the marketing, the assembly, the fabrication, but you also have the sales and the service. Yeah. So it's like sometimes we look at our structure and it looks very top heavy in a lot of ways. Like we have to have so much like
support
built into the company. And then if you try and evaluate it on the standard of like who's creating dollars, like value, you know, the assembly team is fairly small.
Right. Right.
Compared to that, because of the huge undertaking it is to be a manufacturer, not only that, but to then also be selling these things and servicing and all that stuff. So scaling up what that looks like is actually really a positive for, it's the only way forward really for us, in the sense that that will allow us to kind of all we have to do is just fill in that another assembly hand behind this one, and then another one, right, and then another one, you know, and then the system starts to start making more and more sense as well. So it's really, we're really excited to be able to do that. And we're so confident, I think, in our ability to maintain the same structure, because we can see that that's really the kind of natural path forward for us. Even doing it exactly the way we do it.
If you guys decided to do more production, are you at a point where you're going to possibly think about bringing on an investor, or are you pretty comfortable in regards to what you guys can take care of, what needs to be taken care of?
Yeah, we've had some early, really small level, I would say seed involvement. A really passionate group of folks that have helped us get to this point.
Awesome.
It does take capital to start this wheel open. Next phase for us is to really nail the execution and continue to do that and continue to take care of our customers. One of my favorite things that at the kind of end of year review is learning how many people found out about us from other customers. You know, we want that word of mouth to be really cooking for us. So, thinking about how we can multiply our real world presence, either with some, targeted dealerships, so that it's got to be the right kind. It can't be, they've got to buy into the idea that this is a weird product too. It doesn't really fit the mold.
We haven't proven that out yet.
Yeah.
We don't have a proven model for dealership, but we do know that there's so much value that the dealer brings to experience, being able to see it, and being able to carry, to find it, help people finance better.
All get those started up the first time,
get it. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Give them the experience of they're not just not being, delivered. Even though typically when it's delivered by us, you get kind of handheld, but, a little bit more of a local in-person real, which is what we want to do is foster that. So So yeah, we're really excited about that. But I think everything you're saying, Grant, kind of highlights that we're the next step for us is really to get more bikes through the line, yep, and expand. Yeah. Not so much trying to reinvent a whole lot and bring up more products. And stuff. Mm-hmm.
Have any of the investments come from owners?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of them.
That's the best.
It's cool.
Because they believe in the product. So
the real,
go ahead. Sorry.
The real interesting thing that we see all the time is that our owners come back for seconds and thirds.
Oh yeah.
And that's not unusual. We have many customers with three or even five Janus bikes.
Right. Wow, that's cool, man.
Wow.
Hey, so if I'm a listener and interested in one of your models, what would you recommend somebody do? Like, if I'm listening to this, take somebody who's listening that has interest. What's the best way to do this?
Got to get on our website, and we have an awesome configurator that Jordan built. He does all the 3D models for our motorcycles, and that's the first way to start to get the wheels turning on what you want. Check out our YouTube channel.
I think YouTube is a great way to dive in.
Okay. Richard does a live stream every Monday night, and it's called the Ramble Stream, which is rambling is our version of motorcycling. Mm-hmm. It's what you do on a Janus. And we have dozens and dozens of current owners sign on. It's become a church for them in some ways that they get on Monday night. They
listen to me read poetry.
Yeah.
And,
nice, man. It's a blend. That's cool.
We talk about motorcycles or what's coming up next, or you know, it's just kind of a neat way for the community to grow. So if anybody that does not know what's going on with Janus Motorcycles, that's a great way to go and get your questions answered and to see what kind of people hang out on Janus Motorcycles. Some of the most interesting people in the world, I would say. We have rocket scientists and, airplane pilots and sailors and boat builders,
Awesome guys.
Vietnam heroes and motel owners. Right. I think just like any sort of, just really the kind of people that say, I'm going to buy into this interesting, I'm going to buy a really interesting motorcycle online, usually have other interesting stories.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
That's a way to learn about what's what we're about and get the human aspect of
we,
it.
We had Rob Brooks on the show, and he rode because he came down. And I asked him, I said, because, one of the things that we took a lot of pride in my shop was when we were building these vintage bike was the fact that you have today's technology, but you feel like you're truly riding an old bike. And that's exactly what he said. He said, because I asked him, I was like, I know you've been to Janus and you close with the guys. And how was it? And he said, I love the egos because it gives you that true feel of riding an older bike. It's not this pretty little, it's just a beautiful ride. The bike is very reliable. It gets out of its own way, but you truly feel like you're riding an old school bike. And he goes, that's the flavor that I left. I was like, then they built it right. If that's how you felt when you got off that bike, that thing is built absolutely perfect. So that's awesome, guys.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So I'm curious if you're mentioning that configurator thing real quick, I think I've lost a couple pounds in drool just playing with that thing. It is so cool. So people who are either looking at purchasing a new bike or if they want to follow along with your story outside of YouTube and the website, what are some other good avenues that people can stay in the loop?
Instagram, Facebook, Janus, to search for Janus Motorcycles on any of those. That's really come to the shop. We had, and just saw the sale from the test rider come through. So if you want to get the full experience, you can go to the source itself and come, there's a calendar. You can schedule a test ride. We have people fly in from all over the country to do that. It's perfectly normal. And we'll tell you where to get your breakfast and your lunch too.
Cool.
And you can see and meet all the people that will be nearby. And we'll, we can help you design it. You can take a test ride. But that's not essential. 95% of our customers get that experience on YouTube or, following along with us or listening to podcasts like this, and they call us. If you don't like talking on the phone, you're probably in the wrong spot because you don't get through an order without talking to a human at Janus. You can't be
anonymous and get a Janus motorcycle. You are a face and a name to us, and it is a hands-on process, but
that speaks to the service you provide. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question.
So is there any chance that when we come up for a tour, would we be able to see the inner Amish world?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rob, we got to get up there, sir.
Rob, all the way through.
Yeah, for sure, man. I'd love to. You guys come to Florida, you guys come see us. So that would be okay. That'd be awesome. All right, man. So I guess we're ready for the speed round, boys. Here's the deal, right? We got 2 minutes on the clock. You each get to answer the question. If you guys don't, if you go past the 2 minutes, then you have to send Ben and I a 450 each of our color jerseys. All right. True. So those are the rules. And if you do,
you have our face and name.
Do it in time, then you're good. All right. So yeah, let's start it up. Let's go, Ben. 2 minutes on the clock. All right. We'll see. Brent, we'll go from you to Richard. All right. So you go first.
Ready.
All right. Yep. What is the best motorcycle beside Janus that you've ever owned or ridden?
My Yamaha XJ650.
Richard?
KLR 650.
All right. Grant, if your motorcycle could talk, what would yours say about you?
Get out of your office.
Nice.
Let's go. Ramble on. Here we go. Right.
Cool. Best place you've ever rode and why?
The Olympic Peninsula on a Phoenix 250. Nice.
Northern Michigan.
Okay. 250 also?
250, okay. Yep. Got a video on it.
Yep. What's the most embarrassing song on your playlist?
Enya, I don't know.
Enya, okay.
Sure. Enya, nice.
I'll go with Yanni.
Yanni, all right. It's relaxing at times. So. All right, if you...
It's a long...
Yeah, for sure. If you could time travel, which era would you visit and why?
I don't know. Late Roman Republic.
Wow.
Nice. I was going to say Ancient Greece.
Ancient Greece, obviously. The architecture there where it all began. Yeah, yeah. That's beautiful. For sure.
I got to interrupt. So the name Janus, does that coincide with that?
Yep. Yeah. Janus is he's not a Greek god. He's a Roman god. Two faces, one faces to the past and one the future. So he often symbolized like war and peace and dichotomies in the road.
Right.
So it's very fitting.
That's a great name, by the way. Great name. All right. A favorite motorcycle movie of all time?
World's Fastest Indian.
I love that one too.
You got it.
That's up there on my list too. I'm gonna.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great movie. You can't go wrong with that one. All right. Who was your movie crush when you were a teenager?
Yeah, I don't know.
See, Richard's got it easy. He's got time to think.
Okay. Yeah, that's not fair.
Grant, you're on.
I don't know a music movie star, but Norah Jones is my...
Okay, school, all right, cool.
Musician. Voice. Yep.
I don't know, probably like the chicken Run Lola Run.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. If you could meet and have dinner with one person, past or present, who would it be?
Man. Neil Armstrong. That'd be cool. Yeah.
Good one.
We'll see a space buff. That would be neat.
Okay.
George Bruff.
Who is it?
There you go.
George Bruff.
Oh, Bruff. Okay. All right. Cool. One law you would change if you were president for the motorcycle community?
These are good questions. I hope I'm not giving you guys a 450.
I already know what color I want, so slow down. Take your time, buddy. Take your time.
I'm a helmet stickler, and I don't know that it should be legislated, but
okay, helmet law required, right?
I hope that everybody wears a helmet. Okay. I don't know if that's
listen,
way to say that everybody should wear a helmet when you ride a bike. So
I'm gonna go the other direction and say lane splitting and no helmet laws.
All right, there's the yin and yang. We got you guys. All right, good.
I don't know that it should be wet. Everybody should. Maybe that's the difference.
Yeah. All right. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I know.
You go first. Sorry.
I'd say one of our business partners, people that I look up to, mentor, said that, or wasn't a one word, but it's relationships and fostering them and maintaining them over time. Awesome. I could not, this is becoming more and more clear the older I get, the more I do this.
Another Mark Zweigism, which he's our CFO.
He's our CFO.
His patience is not a virtue, and that's a good
one. All right, good one.
It's a good reminder in business, because the time is the only fixed resource that you have, and there's doesn't. You're always on the clock.
That's right. That's for sure. That's great. Great words. All right. If you could get up on stage and sing or jam with any band, who would it be?
The Oscar Peterson Trio.
Okay.
What are you gonna have this one? Oh man. I don't think anybody wants me singing with them.
No, just, whatever, man. Just jam, dance, whatever you want to do. Who would be a band that you do it with?
Oh, man. No, they would go with the Beatles.
The Beatles. All right, cool one.
Cool.
All right, this should be a good one.
AI video, probably.
Yeah.
What is the one piece of clothing you own that you love, but your wife can't stand?
Probably my Duluth Pack hoodie, because I wear it about every other day. Okay. It's my... Our buddies at Duluth Pack, they make very comfortable and very wonderful bags, but also great hoodies. And I come home from work and I'm off with the flannel and on with the hoodie.
All right, cool. You, Rich?
I remember years ago, I really got into making my own wax canvas. And it doesn't, when you make it yourself, it has a kind of interesting smell.
Right.
Very waterproof. So probably one of my wax canvas jackets.
All right.
That one actually walked lawsuit.
Yeah. It stands up when you
just get out. That's funny. All right. If they made a biker theme movie about you, who would play you?
Oh, man.
Because he looks much better than me, probably Harry Connick Jr.
Okay. All right. Harry Connick Jr. I bet.
Gotta have the facial hair and the forehead and the hair.
Okay.
And my wife probably actually watched the movie then.
You'll have me on. Who's tall? I'm 6'6".
Yeah, man.
You're 6'6"?
Yeah, tall.
6'6"?
Richard, you're 6'6"?
I'm 6'6". Who's the guy that... Jim from The Office. He's a tall dude.
Yeah.
He's the new Reacher. I forget.
Yeah. No. Not Jack Reacher, but the... Tom Clancy. It's... what is it? One of my favorite shows. It's John Krasinski.
There you go.
Okay.
And it's one of Tom Clancy's.
Yeah. We know which one it is. Well, we can slow this down because I'm still thinking of the colors I'm choosing. So, all right, let's do this. What's the silliest superstition you follow before or after a ride?
For riding,
I don't have a superstition around that.
No.
Jack Ryan.
Yep.
Yeah.
Jack Ryan, you're right. Thank you.
You go with superstition. I don't really have any.
Obsessively hit my turn signal cancel. That's my writing tick.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sure, it's off.
No, none. Okay. And last one. Beside the One Gang Worldwide podcast, obviously, what is your other favorite podcast?
I got to give a shout out to Christopher Lockhead on marketing. He's been our marketing mentor, and he's helped us grow a lot. That's my pick for that.
Okay, cool. Mine is Tom Holland and Christian or Dominic Sandbrook. The rest is history.
Oh, okay, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a great one. All right, guys, 1:59, man, you made it. That sucks for us, but great for you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right on the clock, man. So you guys just made.
We're like generous with that one.
Hey, man, from the bottom of our hearts, man, I've been chasing you guys down for a while, so I'm so stoked that we got both of you on the show. And as a small business owner here myself, just love to see what you guys are doing. I love to see that the customer service approach, the quality, the jobs you're providing, building an American product. So keep up the amazing work. We love following you guys, and we wish you nothing but the best for the future.
Thank you so much for saying all that. And thank you likewise for having us on.
All right.
This has been a lot of fun.
All right, cool. Really fun. Cool.
Awesome. Thanks for taking the time, guys. We really appreciate it. A lot of fun.
Come up and ride. Gotta get
we
up
will.
Here.
We we'll will. We down. Promise Please. You, man. We promise you we will. We get the show off the ground, get little funds behind us, man, and we're taking a trip to see you guys.
Got it.
All right. Be safe.
Thank you, guys. Be good.
Safe and have a great 2024 with Janice and health and everything else in life.
You too. Thank you.
All right, guys.